Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The biggest oil spill in U.S. history, stagnating middle-class wages, and the near collapse of the U.S. financial system, the challenges we face are daunting. And new polls suggest Americans are losing faith in our ability to tackle these problems. Confidence in Congress, big business, banks, and the Supreme Court is dropping. Joining me to talk about implications of this lack of faith, Jerry Seib. He's executive Washington editor for The Wall Street Journal. Andrew Kohut, he's director of the Pew Research Center for People in the Press. And E.J. Dionne, he's senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a columnist for The Washington Post. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us with a tweet. Join us on Facebook. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning. Good morning, Diane.
Jerry Seib, you wrote about this in a column yesterday in the Wall Street Journal. Explain what's going on with this lack of faith.
Well, what I was curious about was why, in reaction to the Great Recession of 2008, the country seemed to first move left politically in the 2008 election and now seems to be moving right politically, and why that's the case. And I think what if you step back and look at it, what you see is a kind of lack of public confidence that anybody's solutions will work here. They thought maybe government's the answer, but then they've looked at it for a year or so and think, well, maybe not the government's the answer. But I think the story behind those kinds of reactions is much bigger. It's there is no particular faith in the institution of government to solve problems. And it's part of a broader trend over the last 20 years of declining confidence in institutions of every kind. And in Congress, in banks, in businesses, in the Supreme Court, in all kinds of national institutions, there's just less faith that people who are in the elites know what they're doing and know how to solve problems.
So when you say the past 20 years, so you're not just talking about the beginning of the Obama administration.
No. I mean, for example, Gallup, as Andy well knows, has been asking people for the last couple of decades and beyond what their confidence is in various American institutions every year. And if you look at those numbers, you see, for example, that in the last 20 years, the confidence in banks has fallen from 32% to 22%, in big business from 26% to 16%, in the Supreme Court from 48% to 39%. In our own polling of the Wall Street Journal, NBC News, you know, we asked people a question this year: how often do you think the government it will be right when it tries to do something? And 20 years ago, 42% of people said they trusted the government to do what was right just about always or most of the time. Well, that number is now down to 25%. So you have lots of indications of just kind of a loss of faith or a loss of confidence in institutions, starting with the government perhaps, but certainly not limited to the government.
Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal. Andy Kohut, your polls show very, very similar trends. Give us some details.
Well, distrust in government is at one of the record levels of the past 60 years. It is as low as it was at the end of the Carter administration, the so-called malaise period, 22% saying they have confidence in the federal government to do the right thing, to get it right, rather. Attitudes toward Congress, ratings of Congress are at an all-time low. And one of the interesting things is politically, both parties are poorly regarded. Generally, when one party comes down, in this case, the Democrats have come down because they were better regarded than the Republicans in recent years, the other party goes up. That hasn't happened. If you add together the favorability ratings of the Democrats and the Republicans, you don't get to 100%. And those are independent measures, potentially 200%. And it's very unusual to have such broad political discontent, and discontent with just about everything. Not only discontent with government, but the same large percentages saying that they think big business is having a negative impact. They think that Wall Street is having a negative impact on the country. There is only one large institution that gets good ratings. That's technology companies. Of a long list of that we queried about, just about all large institutions are seen as not having a good impact on life in America, save technology companies. An interesting exception.
Andrew Kohut of the Pew Center for Research. E.J. Dionne, didn't this same thing happen when FDR came into office? Can't it be shown that these sort of trends go up and down, going back into history?
Well, I think the difference that Jerry is pointing to is that Herbert Hoover had been president for 3 years, and the Depression got worse. FDR took over. At that moment, the country was prepared to blame Hoover and the Republicans and Wall Street in a serious way, and that FDR came in. And at that moment, more people had confidence in government's ability to pull us out of the mess. I think in Obama's case, he has had the fortune in the campaign of having the crash start during the campaign, which helped him win. But the misfortune that a lot of the bad news really started kicking in on his watch, or as in Roosevelt's case, it all hit under Hoover. And actually, things got better between the 32 and 36 elections in the economy. But I want to point to an important anomaly in these numbers, or an explanation that comes from a very good report Andy did in April. Confidence in government in recent years almost always drops when Democrats take over. Why is that? It's because Republicans really, really mistrust government whenever it's run by Democrats. Just to pick from Andy's poll, the average level of trust in government among Republicans during George Bush's administration was 50%. Under Barack Obama, it's 12%, a complete collapse. So there is a huge partisan reaction going on among Republicans. Democrats, on the other hand, tend to mistrust government no matter who's in power. So that even under Bill Clinton, he left office very popular, but mistrust of government averaged 34% among Democrats under Clinton, 33% under Obama. No change. So some of these numbers are driven by an intense Republican reaction against the Democrats. Now, the one caveat on what I'm saying is there is a loss of ground for confidence in government among independents. And in the elections, and now especially among Republican-leaning independents, but it's some of those independents are the folks Obama and the Democrats have to give a little more confidence to if they're to survive in these fall elections.
E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and Brookings Institution. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Andy, you want to add?
Yeah, there's one other big factor in this perfect storm of conditions that's led to disenchantment with government and many other things, and that is a bad economy. Yeah. If you track confidence in government and satisfaction with the economy, it's a very parallel relationship. So we have all of these things coming together to make this extremely nasty mood in an election year.
And the interesting thing is, if you had a loss of confidence in government but a lot of confidence in the private sector, then you could clearly say there's going to be a move to the right. But what you have is a loss of confidence across the board. So you have a lack of trust in government, but you also have a lack of trust in big business, in the banks, in Wall Street. And I think you're already seeing this play out in politics. Republicans hope that the election can be organized simply around a lack of confidence in government, in which case they could do pretty well. Democrats want it to be about a lack of confidence in Wall Street, big business, and the banks. And you saw them play that card during the fight over Wall Street reform. And the Republicans clearly realized they didn't want to really be seen as standing in the way of this because they know how unpopular the Wall Street has become in the country.
Jared.
Well, and I think that's also why the electoral consequences of this mood have seemed so erratic. You know, you had Republicans winning big governor's races last year in Virginia and New Jersey, and they thought, and I think probably lots of us thought, that meant they were ascendant. Yet you've had the Democrats win a whole series of special elections to fill vacant seats in the House. And so people look at that and they scratch their heads, and they particularly are scratching their heads after one last week in which Democrats won a very hotly contested seat in Pennsylvania to fill the seat of the late John Murtha. And Republicans put lots of eggs in that basket, thought they were going to win it, lost it by 8 percentage points. And people are saying, well, what's going on? We thought there's a move to the right and a move toward the Republicans, which there is. But it's not that simple, and that's, I think, the overall consequence of this.
Andy.
I think to a certain extent that we have to disentangle disenchantment and a move to the right. I think a lot of the move to the right is reaction to Obama among Republicans and among independents who were concerned about his being way to the left of him, of them, and looking at his policies. And last year we saw public opinion become more conservative on a range of issues, from gun control to abortion to the size of government. So those are related things, but there's an independence to them, and there's a partisan factor going on there. But I think this issue of the unpredictability of the consequences of these trends is really the important one. We don't have a situation where we have a classic setup for a wave election, where one party has people have lost faith in one party and say, well, let's give those other folks a try, because people are saying no to both parties. And it's, I mean, as I sit here, I would bet on Republican gains, but the size of those gains are going to be tempered by the level of disenchantment and distrust of both parties.
EJ.
I think I'm going to spend the whole day saying but. because, again, and this goes back to a point Andy made to me on the street about a month ago, where Obama himself has not been brought down nearly as far as all of these other numbers. Obama's popularity has hovered around 45% to 52%, somewhere in that range. The point Andy made is there is a disconnect between the view of Obama and the view of the Congress. Obama's view is the public's view of Obama is more positive than the view of Democrats in Congress, and they're going to try to bring those into line during this campaign.
EJ Dion, and when we come back, we'll talk about the Tea Party and its effects. Welcome back. As we talk about the lowering of confidence by the American public in all of our institutions, not only in government, but in big business, in the banks, even the Supreme Court. Here's an email from Jennifer in Cincinnati, Ohio. She says, please ask about wagging of the dog. It's gone over the last several years with conservative talk shows and pundits saying constantly, our government is broken and doesn't work, backing this up with exaggerations, even lies, mainly because it serves their political purposes. EJ.
Well, this is an odd thing. Decline in confidence in government started under President Bush when people went south, public opinion went south on the Iraq War, and the economy started to deteriorate. And some of the resentment you're hearing on the right and in the Tea Party movement is resentment against Bush and the Republicans. A lot of these Republicans, contrary to the view of some of us, say, well, Bush just wasn't conservative enough. But in terms of this anti-government feeling, Republicans have used this, sometimes with success and sometimes not, for going on 40, almost 50 years, I would say. And I once got an email from an ardent Democratic reader who said Republicans get elected by saying government can't work and then spend their time in office proving it. Well, when government doesn't work and Republicans are in power, it helps Republicans. But It's particularly damaging when Democrats are in power, because Democrats are the party that says government can do good things for people. And I think it's imperative that a Democratic administration do things to restore public confidence in the way government works. It's why I, along, may be one of the only people who thinks Al Gore's Reinventing Government initiative was actually very important, because I think it was central to what progressives have to do when they're in government.
All right. Let's,
Al Gore probably believes that.
Jerry, let's talk about the passage of health care, financial reform, regulatory reform, and how they affect perceptions that maybe the government under President Obama has moved to the left too fast, too far.
Well, that's a very subjective question, obviously, because what you consider to be too far to the left or too fast to the left depends on what you think the center is, and that's a subject of some dispute, obviously. I think the more relevant question is, did the Obama administration overreach? Did it just simply try to do too much and scare people? And, in some ways, I think that's going to have to be a question for the historians to sort out, you know, years from now, because the answer depends in part on how all this turns out. In other words, when the economy bounces back, will it be seen as having been rescued from the precipice by the government's actions and having improved faster than it would have otherwise? Will the healthcare overhaul be seen as having worked? Will the Wall Street reform be seen as having saved the country from going down this path again? If the answer to all those questions are positive, then I think the notion that there was an overreach will simply not hold water over time. The short term we're all thinking about is between now and the November election, mm-hmm. and it's going to be hard to say those are all going to turn out great between now and November. They're not.
Anthony.
Well, I think that the debate about health care reform did an awful lot to raise concerns about the size of government. When Barack Obama took office, the public was pretty much evenly divided between wanting a big government that offers a lot of services or a small government that offers few services. At this point in time, the margin is 50% in favor of a small government versus only 39% in favor of a large government. So there has been a real change in mind about government, and I think a big part of that is anxiety that was brought about as a consequence of that health care reform debate.
E.J., what about the Tea Party movement, and to what extent does it capture this sense of lack of faith?
Well, my own view is that the Tea Party movement is not a lot beyond, and it's important in this way, beyond an angry and discontented right wing of the Republican Party, a kind of libertarian anti-government right in the Republican Party that always appears when Democrats take power. There are some of the slogans that you hear in the Tea Party movement that you can go all the way back to the New Deal and find that those slogans, you know, the president's a socialist, he's making government big, this endangers our constitutional liberties being a key phrase both in the opposition to Roosevelt and now in the opposition to Obama. I don't think, beyond a certain number of independents who are, in any event, quite conservative, that the Tea Party movement captures what's going on in the country as a whole. I actually think there's a disconnect between the base of the Republican Party, which genuinely is angry, and the rest of the country, which is disgruntled and unhappy in certain ways, but not as angry as the Tea Party reflects.
I agree with what E.J. said, although I have a caveat. I think that to the extent what E.J. is describing as the anger in the Tea Party, I think that's right. But I think there's another element here, which is scared, not just angry. There's the people in the Tea Party movement because they're scared. And they're scared because of the economic conditions of the country. And they're particularly scared because of debt and deficits. And I think that's very real. And I think that's a concern that both parties are going to have to deal with. And I think it's a growing sense and people watch what's happening in Greece, and they're going to get this feeling even more so that this problem of debt and deficit has the potential to destroy the American way of life, and that's a little bit of exaggeration, but that it's real and nobody's dealing with it, and so the Tea Party says, well, let's make a noise about it, and that's what people are doing.
I think that this notion of the Republic, of the appeal of the Tea Party to Republicans has to do with feelings of Republicans and conservatives feeling threatened and powerless. They see have seen the Republican Party as leaderless and adrift, and they want someone to take charge and sing their song. And the Tea Party has done that, and it's appealed to a lot of conservative Republicans, almost as many who say that the Tea Party reflects their views as say that about the Republican Party more generally.
And that's why this Rand Paul race in Kentucky is going to be so interesting, because Rand Paul represents, in as pure a form as we've seen in a Senate race, the libertarian anti-government strains of this movement. And that's why he got into trouble, because he really didn't support the public accommodation section of the Civil Rights Act, because this was government interfering with private business. He doesn't really want to be tough on BP because he doesn't like government interfering with private business. And we're going to see if Paul kind of just hangs back and sort of tries to muddle his libertarian views, or if he comes out there swinging and says, this is what I believe, let's see what happens. But we're going to have a real test of the popularity of these views, not just within a Republican primary, which Rand Paul won by a very impressive margin, but within the whole electorate, which I don't think takes this same view of government.
It's so interesting when you hear about this more government, less government. You hear someone like Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal saying, we got to have more help. We've got to have the government come in here, take over, do something about what's happening.
Well, again, you know, people like the government that helps them, and they don't like the government that helps the other guy. That's a kind of a time-honored reaction to government. That's why I think a lot of what passes as complaints about too much government is really complaints about too much spending. And it's not the same thing. And if the deficit weren't $1.3 trillion, I think people would worry less about how much government there is around them and in the country's life. But I also go back to what Andy said. I think a lot of this has to do with a very searing debate on health care, which is a very emotional issue. Everybody lives that issue one way or the other. And it forced people to think hard about what the role of government is in their lives. And the country hasn't really decided.
But, EJ, how is this spill likely to affect people's thinking about what the government's role should be?
Well, personally, I hope it affects their view a lot, because in the end, you're faced with this odd situation where everyone says, we want the government to do something. And the commander of the Coast Guard comes out and very honestly says, well, wait a minute, all this stuff is actually owned by a private company, and the government really can't do much about it. I think we're going to go back and look at how weak the regulation was of offshore drilling. Whether you're for or against offshore drilling, if you're going to do it, you better have good regulation in place. And the question, I think, in terms of the larger effect of this on the political debate, is whether in the end more people blame the government somehow for failing to act, or whether they put the blame on BP, Halliburton, Transocean, the private companies that did this. And I think you're going to see a real struggle over that narrative, to use the year's popular word.
Well, there's more blame being assigned to BP than to the government, for sure. But I also think that calls for government at a time of an emergency and catastrophe are natural, and they're not going to have much of an effect on broader attitudes toward the desirability of a bigger government or more government that provides more services. When there's an emergency, there's an attack, some catastrophe, people will say government, and that's independent of their view about what the size of government should be and what the role of government should be in a whole range of things.
But what about an agency like the FDA? Doesn't the American public want that kind of protection, assurance that the government has done the kind of testing it needs to do?
Sure, and they want air traffic controllers in the
right
tower keeping the planes from smashing into each other. But I think what's interesting, Dan, is that what we're embarked upon, and this is actually beginning at the states and is only coming at the federal level, is a real national debate about what are essential government services. I mean, I think there's a realization, if you lived in California, it's a startling realization that the government can't afford to do all the stuff it's been doing. And so we will have to, as a nation, decide what is it that's really essential and what can we let go. And so far in the last 100 years or so, people haven't had to make that choice very often. And now they're facing the prospect of doing it. And you're raising good questions. I don't think there's a clear national consensus on what is an essential government service and what can we let go, but we're going to have to figure it out over the next few years, I think.
You know, our political science articles come and go, but there is an incredibly enduring political science article written now, I think about a half century ago, by Hadley Free and Lloyd Cantrell. And Free and Cantrell said that Americans are ideological conservatives and operational liberals. And what they meant is that in theory, Americans will say they're anti-government, they're individualists, they value individual liberty, so they don't really trust government. But in practice, they're operational liberals because they count on government to do a lot of things. They want a lot of things from government. You even see this contradiction in members of the Tea Party movement where they're anti-government, especially if they're over 65. They're anti-government everywhere except Social Security and Medicare. They're operational liberals despite their Tea Partyism.
E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We'll open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Battle Creek, Michigan. Good morning, Lenny. You're on the air.
Good morning. I want to know what your panel thinks about this. I think we're in the early stages of the middle class and the majority of Americans, because it's now affecting them, realizing what a minority of us have known for some time, for a good 30, 40 years, since at least Eisenhower days, that, you know, you look at the FDA, you look at this mine safety administration, you look at, you know, all our governmental agencies are representing corporations. And it's that simple. Our government, people are flailing around now politically because neither party is doing anything, because government is not in the people's interest now. It is serving the corporations.
EJ.
You know what's fascinating about this gentleman's call is I think he explains this point from Andy's poll that I raised earlier, that we talk about the discontent on the right, but we don't talk much about the discontent on the left. The right mistrusts government because they don't trust government. But parts of the left mistrust government because they think government's in bed with the big corporations. And when you look at these trust in government numbers, you can't just look at them as a rebellion on the right. There are some people, 40% of Democrats think of themselves as liberals. Some of those liberals don't think that the Obama administration has been tough enough on Wall Street. They're asking questions about how offshore drilling was regulated, let alone the president's decision to allow it. So I think that government takes it from both sides in our political culture, which again explains why these numbers at the moment are so low.
But this is sort of where right and left come together. The left distrusts big business. The Tea Party distrusts big business. The left, may or may not trust mistrust big government, but they certainly mistrust big banks, and so does the Tea Party movement. The word "big" is the word that really makes people in the Tea Party movement nervous. But it in many ways, the result on the left and the right is the same, which is they kind of see an establishment that's not working in their interest, and that's what they're reacting to.
All right, to Milford, New Hampshire. Good morning, Matthew. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
In step with probably the last caller, it's true that the distrust of American government does not come from Democrat or Republican. It's not partisan. It is the fact that corporate America occupies Washington, D.C. Special interests completely occupy and control the legislature. Nothing gets through. As a politically active person in my state, I can see that the apathy of the electorate. Nobody wants to get involved. They believe that corporate America and the bottom line is what absolutely powers the engines of democracy nowadays, or the engines of America nowadays, and that we have absolutely no say anymore in our government as individuals and as communities, because our legislatures only listen to special interests. Special interests have their ear 365 days a year, and we only have their ear when they need to be elected or when they want our tax dollars to bail out big corporate America.
You know, in response to Matthew's comments, one of the ways in which our survey failed a couple of months ago was to try to get at what distinguishes attitudes toward elected officials. And there was so much common discontent about elected officials being self-serving, only interested in elections and listening to special interest groups, that it was almost a useless question because people said, yes, they do that, yes, they do that, yes, they do that, and there was almost no variation politically.
It shows, I think this caller suggests why Obama and the Democrats have a lot of work to do, both in the middle of the electorate and on the left of the electorate. One of the surprising things that happened on financial reform or Wall Street reform, the bill that just went through the Senate, is for the first time, Senate moved a bill left rather than right. Mm-hmm. And I think it's in response to this anger out there at Wall Street.
All right. When we come back, more of your calls, and we'll talk about loss of faith in the Supreme Court.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works at education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. By the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And by Intel Corporation, in recognition of NPR's ongoing commitment to science and technology coverage. This is NPR.
The May Reader's Review, a discussion of Little B by Chris Cleave. It's the story of a teenage Nigerian girl and an educated British couple whose tragic encounter on an African beach forever alters their lives. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. We're talking about the apparent loss of faith in institutions, not only the government, but big business, the court, almost every institution we know of in this country. Jerry Saad, talk about the lowering of confidence in the Supreme Court. What does that look like? Where do you think it's coming from?
Well, over the last 10 years, it's dropped from 49% in the Gallup surveys to 39%. So, two things to be said about it: it's not a precipitous drop, and secondly, it still ranks higher than other institutions. So, it hasn't fallen off the table, and it still is held in higher esteem than lots of other institutions. I'm not sure what drives it. You know, you would naturally conclude that maybe it was the very contentious December 2000 decision to decide the 2000 presidential election. But if you look at the Gallup numbers, the drop-off actually begins in the mid-2000 and 2005. And maybe it's just a sense on both sides of the aisle, in both wings of the country, that the court's gotten too partisan or too political. I'm not sure I can interpret it. And maybe it's just a drift down along with all other institutions.
I looked at these numbers a long time ago, but not the most recent ones. I think you have simply had a very sharp drop among liberals in their view of the court, that if you go back to decisions, starting with Brown v. Board of Education and the one-person, one-vote decision, a whole series of decisions. The court seemed to liberals as a bulwark for them. Now you have a court under effective conservative control, not consistently, but increasingly consistently, most recently in the Citizens United decision. And so I think that the court, I think it was Justice Stevens predicted in Bush v. Gore, is no longer seen as a neutral arbiter, and it's certainly not seen by liberals as a force for their side of politics.
All right, we'll go back to the phones, this time to southwestern Pennsylvania. Good morning, Justin. You're on the air.
Hello, Diane. I'd like to say I'm a huge fan, and I've been listening for years.
Thank you.
I hate to sound really cynical, and I certainly feel that this is a legitimate conversation to have, but I guess I just question the validity of these polls, given like just the fickle nature of the American sentiment, and it's like ability to be swayed by Pepsi and Fox News and the Slanket. You know, how reliable ultimately are the views and opinions of people that are consistently less stable than Sybil?
Well, you see in these polls largely a stable set of attitudes that change in reasonable and logical understandable ways. There's nothing in the polling that we've been talking about, Gallup or Pew or NBC Wall Street Journal, that suggests that that public opinion is wavering and floating and incoherent. In fact, you see a very coherent response to many of the things that are going on, which isn't to say that polls are perfect and that there isn't a fair margin of error associated with some of these attitudes, which some of which are squishy. But I think the polls present a picture of a pretty rational and, at this point, angry rational public.
All right. San Antonio, Texas. Jan, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'd like to, you know, healthcare debate, what debate? You can't have a debate in a soundbite kind of atmosphere and, fear-mongering all the time. Corporations and big media do a terrible job of informing the public of what it needs to know. The RNC and talk radio are largely to blame. There are keywords that are used every day. It's scary, terrifying. These are frightening times. The public's being whipped up into some kind of frenzy. The Tea Party movement, fringe lunatics. Racism, homophobia, you name it. I counter-protested here in San Antonio. These people were some of the most misguided, angry individuals I'd ever met. It's all psychological manipulation, if you ask me.
DJ.
Well, I think the caller shows how divided we are as a country, to say the least. And I am personally critical of the Tea Party movement. But I think that when you look back at 2009, while I agree that there were enormous distortions, notably death panels that didn't exist, introduced in that debate, I think what happened in 2009 is that Democrats lost the two important battles over narrative, to use that popular word again. The Republicans, for whatever reason, including their effective, hardline media, got to define the health care bill more than the Democrats did. So they also got to define the stimulus more than the Democrats did. I think the stimulus helped prevent the economy from getting much, much worse. And I think the evidence is overwhelming that that's the case. But the public didn't come to see that because the economy didn't come all the way back. I would say that's because the stimulus was too small. But we can have that argument another day. Now, I think the argument is opened up again. And once health care has passed, what struck me is that even Republicans who say they want to repeal it don't say they want to repeal the whole thing. They use the slogan repeal and replace. Why is that? Because there are a lot of elements, particular elements in the health care bill that are popular. And I don't see at the moment the Republicans using the health care issue except in their own base, which tells me that there is still a shot at winning that argument that this health care bill is far more progress than it is problem.
What's the danger for Republicans here as they target Democrats and what Democrats are doing? Jerry?
Well,
First of all, I will rise to the defense of the Tea Party movement here. I mean, any movement like this has cranks and crazy people on the fringes, but I think there's a legitimate concern about debt and deficit in particular, as I said before, that drives a lot of people who already are economically stressed and worried about the future of their families and their country to want to do something about it, and the Tea Party movement is offering that, and I think that's a perfectly legitimate and periodic movement that you see in American politics. So that's the first thing. And by the way, that is beneficial to Republicans by and large because it's generating enthusiasm among people who are going to vote Republican way more than they're going to vote Democrat. So that's the plus. The danger for Republicans is that they kind of allow them they'll allow themselves to get carried away and to be either colored by or lumped together with these more extreme elements of the Tea Party movement. And that, you know, when Rand Paul says, I'm not sure the 1964 Civil Rights Act really worked out right, you saw a lot of Republicans who disassociated themselves from that notion very quickly because they don't want to go there. And similarly, I'm not sure they want to go as far on immigration policy, for example, as some people in the Tea Party movement. So I think the tricky thing for Republicans is to embrace the energy of the Tea Party movement, but not embrace all of its attributes.
And that gets, Jerry, to the $64 question about this coming election. Midterm elections are shaped by turnout. And what is all of this anger and disenchantment going to do to turnout? Is it going to be the angry, disillusioned people on the right who are much more fired up than the people in the middle? Who don't have such a clear partisan point of view? Will the liberal Democrats who are disillusioned with government or maybe a little disappointed in what Barack Obama has done come out and vote for Democratic candidates? The history is that when people are discontented, turnout goes up in elections. Will that be the case this year? And how will it be distributed politically in terms of the anger?
I think Andy has put his finger on the thing the Democrats most have to fear, which is what we have seen in the polls is the enthusiasm gap, that people on the right seem more enthusiastic about voting than people in the middle or on the left. However, that's where that Pennsylvania special election becomes very, very interesting, where none of that materialized. The Republicans ran a kind of cookie-cutter anti-Obama, anti-Pelosi campaign in a district where President Obama is very unpopular, according to the polls, and they got swamped. And the Republicans are saying, well, there was a Democratic primary that day, the Sestak Specter primary that brought out a lot of Democrats. Well, whatever it showed that Democrats, at least in this case, in this state, were enthusiastic enough about voting to turn out to elect this Democrat. And I think Jerry put his finger on something. I think this election hangs in part on whether the enthusiasm gap closes, but in part on whether middle-of-the-road voters who have fallen away, if you will, from Obama and the Democrats, take a look at this rather extreme face that some of the folks in the Republican Party are putting on their party. They're doing it out of principle, but a lot of other people think it's extreme. Whether that knocks a few of those middle-of-the-road independents back to the Democrats who say, I'm not completely happy with where I am, but I can't vote for this other party. If that happens, I think the Democrats are going to do okay. They'll take some losses, but not lose the House.
You know, we've talked a lot about government, but what about these other institutions? What about the banks? What about the schools? What about the other institutions that Americans used to feel represented them, were on their side? What about them, Jerry?
Well, you know, Andy noted technology companies. People have faith in them. There's another one that still holds in there in terms of public esteem, and that's the military. People still think the military is an institution that works and that does well. They, by and large, say that about organized religion, although that's drifted down a little bit. But I think a lot of the mood now, it basically looks askance at big business and big banks. Now, the emphasis there, I think, is on big. People are much more likely to trust small business than big business. That's always been true. The difference now is that most of their interaction is with big businesses, not small businesses, and that bothers them, I think. And I also think that, you know, the school system, people have been complaining about public schools going downhill for 20 years. Well, now you're seeing the logical result. It's not a coincidence that the Obama administration has moved pretty far to the right on public school reform and gotten lots of applause across the spectrum for having done so. That tells you that there's a consensus forming that schools aren't doing what they're supposed to do. At least they're not doing as well as they're supposed to do it.
besides the concerns about the economy and the recession, there is a broader concern about the nature of American society that's underneath all of this. As I was leaving the Gallup organization in the late 1980s, we asked a question which says, do you think this is a have-not society? And 71% said, no, it's not a have-not society. In Britain at that time, and maybe even today, people would say, yes, this is a society that's distinguished by haves and have-nots. Subsequently, in the 90s, even when times were good, many people were saying, we have as many as 40% saying, yes, this is a have-not society. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that middle-income people haven't experienced any real income gains over a long period of time, and they look at big business and success of Wall Street and the conditions now, and they say, what's going on here?
We're often contradictory. I mean, this anti-bigness goes way back in our history. You could see it in the populist period, in the progressive period, and anti-big business, anti-big government. But we say we're against business, and millions of us shop at Walmart. We praise Microsoft's products. We all want our Social Security courtesy of big government. I mean, there are contradictions in public opinion. And I think right at the beginning of the show, you pointed to the big one, which is we count on government an awful lot. And then when we're not needing government, we say we can't stand government. And that's, again, very much in our national tradition. And how that contradiction plays out usually determines the results of elections.
And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And let's go now to Woodstock, Illinois. Good morning, Lydia.
Good morning. I want to thank you for this discussion, but I'm so bothered that it centers on this, quote, political cultural thing. This is a situation that civilizations have gone through. Arnold Toynbee, please put him on your reading list and do it fast. We are in what he refers to as a time of troubles. This is not new. The societies that pull through this look at it as a challenge. We also need political cooperation, because when you have that type of thing, you have the extremes, the wag the dog, where the extreme basically determines the role of the whole. All of this has been documented. It's out there. Please get yourself on a hill, look at it from an historical viewpoint, make that what the next issue is about, not numbers, because we need to have that discussion and we need to have it fast. And thank you, but I'm really, really concerned that we're not even scraping the surface when we have all these tools that we can look into and understand what has happened. For instance, when Rome went under, the barbarians took over. Once they took over, they didn't know how to govern. Now, maybe the Tea Party isn't quite there yet, but maybe if they do take over, they have no skills to govern. So thank you, and I appreciate your time.
Well, obviously, that's a thoughtful comment. Two quick reactions to it. One is, we'll see about incumbents. The assumption is that this is a very bad year for incumbents and that they will be swept out and lots of newcomers will come in and they may or may know what they're doing. I guess I'm not convinced yet because, the advantages of being an incumbent tend to bring themselves to the front when you get to the end of a campaign, and we'll see if that happens this year or not. What got me interested in this topic was in fact a historical question, which is that when the country went through the Great Depression the 1932 election rolled around, it went left with Franklin Roosevelt and stayed left for a long time. Mm-hmm. This time we had a similar economic catastrophe, and the country got to the 2008 election and moved left. But now it seems to be moving back right, and that is different. And there says that this is a different period with different kind of cross currents than we've seen in the past, and that's what I think is so interesting about it.
In the end, I am kind of chronically hopeful about the United States. I think the United States is a country that makes mistakes, but we're rather ingenious at self-correction, and we've seen that over a rather long period in our history. And I do think that all this will look different in 2 or 3 years. We don't know how it will look different. It does seem to me that if the economy improves and some of these measures we're taking to try to make things better, to extend health care, to make the financial system work better, I think we'll look back, as the lady suggested, if I heard her right, that we went through this turbulent time, got through it pretty well, and then we move on to more normal kind of arguments. If things don't get better, what we see out there are some very, very strong and in some cases extreme views. And is it possible we'll tear ourselves apart? It's possible. I'm still betting on the alternative.
No, I think that's right. And you know, the center tends to hold in American politics. I think we've probably all seen that. And the variations are probably never quite as wild. The swings aren't as wild as we sometimes portray them to be. They tend to be within a reasonable spectrum, and the center holds usually in American politics.
Jerry Tsai, B.J. Dion, Andrew Kohut. That's where we leave it for now, and we'll keep checking as those polls keep changing. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.